are, in our study of Genesis, going to turn our attention to that account which is going to really fill up pretty much the rest of the book of Genesis. We have been following up to this point the family of Abraham through the family of Isaac, family of Jacob, and now we're really going to zero in on the descendants of, on Jacob, his family, but particularly on the story of Joseph. If you remember, Joseph was the last born before they left the employ of Laban, Jacob's uncle. They took off and headed back to the land. They had various adventures there. The most serious of the adventures was in the city of Shechem, when one of Jacob's daughters was forcibly taken by the ruler of Shechem, that then the brothers, or Jacob's children, slaughtered everyone in the city of Shechem. And God told them, out of there, took Jacob back to Bethel. The family rededicated themselves to service of God. And for a while, it looked like things were doing pretty much okay. Well, up until now, that is. Genesis chapter 37, verse 1. Now, Jacob lived in the land where his father had sojourned, in the land of Canaan. Most likely, shortly before this, his father, Isaac, had died. Verse 2, these are the records of the generations of Jacob. Not really genealogy as we understand it. We've talked about this in some of the other accounts, these toldot, these beginnings of history, these recounting really of the deeds of someone, not just their generations or not just their genealogy of whoever begat whoever else. Joseph, when 17 years of age, was pasturing the flock with his brothers while he was still a youth, along with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought back a bad report about them to their father. Right, so, since Joseph was born right before they left, most likely they were in the land of Canaan between 15 and 16 years. I doubt they would have left when Joseph was a newborn, but soon thereafter. Keep that in mind, by the way, much later on, that Joseph was 17 years old. I like that, still a youth. I think if there were young people in here, they would bristle at that, 17-year-olds that were considered still a youth. But they certainly were. Another thing about the Hebrew, in verse 2, when it talks about Bilhah and Zilpah, his father's wives, Hebrew is kind of ambiguous about that. It really is just his father's women. Right? Because in Hebrew, there's really not a word for a common word for wife. Even when I would say this person is my wife, I would usually say that is my woman, is the way you'd say it. So this is kind of a little ambiguous. I say that because Bilhah and Zilpah were not really officially married. They were the wives of his, or they were the servants of his wives, Rachel and Leah, whom he impregnated in order to have children when his wives, Leah and Rachel, had stopped bearing children. So Joseph goes out in the field with these sons, Bilhah and Zilpah, and I don't remember which ones they were. And he brings home a bad report about what they were doing. Verse 3, now Israel loved Joseph more than all his sons, because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a very colored tunic. His brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, so they hated him and could not speak to him on friendly terms. In case you haven't picked this up so far with what the brothers did in Shechem and what Reuben did with his father's concubine, that this family was a mess. It was a mess. Even though Scripture does not come out explicitly and condemn polygamy. Still, it kind of shows by example. There's not a family I know of in Scripture that involves polygamy that is not dysfunctional at a great level, and this was no exception. This is just a mess. This is just an absolute mess. Not only was the family in Canaan, but Canaan was solidly in the family. So you think that this sort of simmering jealousy and envy would just kind of sit there, as it does in many families. And maybe it would have, had things not gotten stirred up. Verse 5, then Joseph had a dream. When he told it to his brothers, they hated him even more. He said to them, please listen to this dream which I have had. For behold, we were binding sheaves in the field, and lo, my sheaf rose up and also stood erect. And behold, your sheaves gathered round and bowed down to my sheaf. And his brothers said to him, are you actually going to reign over us? Are you really going to rule over us? So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. If I were Joseph, would I have shared this dream with my brothers? Oh no. As one of those, what were you thinking moments. But he shared it with them. Maybe that says something about Joseph's attitude also, that Joseph needed a little bit of an attitude correction, and oh boy, was he ever going to get one? Was he ever going to get one? Verse 9. Now he had still another dream, and related it to his brothers, and said, lo, I have had still another dream, and behold, the sun and the moon and 11 stars were bowing down to me. In the sun and the moon business, that's talking something else than brothers. And his father realized it. Verse 10, he related it to his father and to his brothers. His father rebuked him and said to him, what is this dream that you've had? Shall I and your mother and your brothers actually come to bow ourselves down before you to the ground? His brothers were jealous of him, but his father kept the saying in mind. And his brothers went to pasture their father's flock in Shechem. Hello? Shechem. What are you doing back there? And that struck me when I read this. It's like God had told them a couple of chapters earlier to come out of Shechem, to come to Bethel, and then live where his father had sojourned. And Jacob did. But the brothers went back to Shechem. Now, why in the world would they do that? I mean, Shechem was this place of this great massacre. Well, in one sense, maybe that's why they went back there. Maybe they had not exactly repented of this, but looked upon Shechem as kind of a symbol of their power and their ability to work their will, and kind of their prowess as warriors or whatever. They went back to Shechem. Why in the world did they do that? I mean, they had this moment of rededication at Bethel, where the family buried all their idols and came back to serve God. And it seemed to have made a difference in Jacob's life, but not in his kids. They're standing on the mountain before God in Bethel, and apparently the kids are still looking off into the distance back at Shechem. Because here they took their flocks back to pasture in Shechem. Verse 13, Israel said to Joseph, are not your brothers pasturing the flock in Shechem? Come, I will send you to them. And he said to him, I will go. Now, why would Jacob have sent Joseph to check up on them unless he thought some mischief was afoot? And maybe even the whole idea of them going back to Shechem made Jacob a little nervous in a lot of ways. Nervous on one part that the brothers might have gotten into trouble on their own, or maybe there were people in the environs of Shechem who had relatives that were slaughtered by the brothers in that incident. And so he picks his trustworthy son, Joseph, and says, go check up on them. Verse 14, then he said to him, go now and see about the welfare of your brothers and the welfare of the flock, and bring back word to me. So he sent him from the valley of Hebron, and he came to Shechem. Shechem was about 20, 30 miles to the north. So on foot, it was quite a journey. It's not something that you just walk over there. It wasn't like a half hour's walk. It was probably a couple days travel in their day. Verse 15, and a man found him. And behold, he was wandering the field. And the man asked him, "What are you looking for?" He said, "I'm looking for my brothers. Please tell me where they are pasturing the flock." The man said, "They have moved from here, for I heard them say, 'Let us go to Dothan.'" So Joseph went after his brothers and found them at Dothan. Dothan was even farther away from his father. Dothan was 10 miles further to the north. Now, if Joseph would have just obeyed the letter of the law of what his father had said, his father said, "Go to Shechem." He went to Shechem. Brothers weren't there. So theoretically, he could come back to dad and say, "Nope, they weren't there." Dad would have said, "Well, why didn't you go any further?" So Jacob decides to go on. And he found them at Dothan. Verse 18, when they saw him from a distance and before he came close to them, they plotted against him to put him to death. I don't know what process it took to get these brothers to that point. So you can kind of see it happening. I mean, you saw it in the incident at Shechem. You saw it in the incident with Reuben. That these people had now become bloodthirsty. That all they desired was to get their will by violence. And so when they see Joseph coming close to them, all they can think of is, "Let's kill the kid." A 17-year-old kid. 17-year-olds are inherently dumb. I mean, they do stupid things. They say stupid things. It should not have upset them that the kid was bragging. Every 17-year-old brags. If every 17-year-old who bragged got put to death, we wouldn't have another generation to carry on because they'd all be dead. But they decided they were going to put him to death. They hated him. Part of it was because of this bad report he brought to his father about them. They just decided, "We got enough of this guy." Verse 19, they said to one another, "Here comes this dreamer. Now then, come and let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits, and we will say a wild beast devoured him. Then let us see what will become of his dreams." These pits, by the way, were probably cisterns. That land, they had quite a few cisterns because of the poor rainfall, the drought, whatever, that cisterns are well known. They're rather large. In some of them, they could easily be 20 feet in diameter and 12 feet deep. So it wasn't just this little pit. It was quite a significant thing, and the way it was constructed was that there was a large system that was kind of bell-shaped, and at the top there was a little hole for getting the water in and out so the water wouldn't evaporate. So once you were thrown down into a cistern, you weren't getting back out unless somebody took you out, because you were stuck. There was no way to climb out. So the plot is they're going to do away with him and then say a wild beast killed him. Verse 21, but Reuben heard this and rescued him out of their hands and said, "Let us not take his life." Reuben further said to them, "Shed no blood. Throw him into this pit that is in the wilderness, but do not lay hands on him, that he might rescue him out of their hands to restore him to his father." There are a lot of issues here in this section about people making half-hearted attempts to do what's right. Could Reuben at that point have just taken the kid and gone? Yeah. Should Reuben at that point, if he had gotten them away from their hands, that he could have said, just taken the kid and said, "Joseph, run." And the two of them run off into the distance, and maybe one or two of the other brothers would have come to their senses and run after them and got him back to his father that way. I mean, there are things that could have been done at that point. Instead, there's this, Reuben wants to save the kid, but not really upset the rest of the brothers. So Reuben is trying to skate this thin line between upsetting the brothers and saving Joseph. Verse 23, so it came about when Joseph reached his brothers that they stripped Joseph of his tunic, the very colored tunic that was on him, and they took him and threw him into the pit. Now the pit was empty without any water in it. They sat down to eat a meal. It's amazing. They throw their brother in a pit. Good morning's work. Right, let's go eat something. So they sat down to eat. And as they raised their eyes and looked, behold, a caravan of Ishmaelites was coming from Gilead with their camels bearing aromatic gum and balm and myrrh on their way to bring them down to Egypt. Dothan was on the trade routes. So this was not an unusual thing. And these were known trade products of the day. Judah said to his brothers, "What profit is for us to kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come and let us sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him, for he is our brother, our own flesh." And his brothers listened to him. So let's sell him as a slave. He's your brother, your own flesh. Why don't you just take him back to his father? Then some Midianite traders passed by. So they pulled him up and lifted Joseph out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. Thus they brought Joseph into Egypt. By the way, this flip-flop between Midianites and Ishmaelites, either it was a mixed caravan, or that people were known for a certain thing that they became so identified with that it wasn't so much about their people as much as their profession. I say that because some of the so-called higher critics go nuts with this, saying that, oh, multiple sources. No, it's just they tended to have multiple names for the same thing. It was just what they did. It's just what they did. So they brought Joseph into Egypt. Now Reuben returned to the pit, and behold, Joseph was not in the pit, so he tore his garments. So one has to ask immediately, where'd he go? The brothers are going to kill the younger brother. Reuben wants to save his life. So where'd he go? Like I said, halfway measures. If there is a group of people that had captured somebody that I wanted to help or save the life, I would not take my eyes off that person. I would not take my eyes. What? He had to go out in the field and, you know, pick some flowers or something? He just left. He was gone. So he comes back and finds Joseph's not there, so he tore his garments. Not helpful. I mean, it expresses the emotion, but tearing garments was not helpful. He turned to his brothers and said, "The boy is not there. As for me, where am I to go?" Now, once again, halfway measure. Wouldn't you have thought at that point, when he found out what they did with the kid, that Reuben could have gone running after the Ishmaelites with whatever money that he had, take the 20 shekels, take whatever else he could find, go running after the Ishmaelites, and bring the kid back, or at the very least, follow him into Egypt so that he can go back and report to the father what had happened to Joseph, so that the family could go and rescue them. I'm thinking of Abraham. When Lot was captured, Abraham gathered all his people together and traveled for days and days to find Lot and rescue him. Instead, Reuben's more or less, "Oh well, he's gone. Woe is me, what am I to do?" Here's a hint, go after him. Verse 31, so they took Joseph's tunic and slaughtered a male goat and dipped the tunic in the blood. They sent the varicolored tunic and brought it to their father and said, "We found this. Please examine it to see whether it is your son's tunic or not." How cold-blooded can you be? How cold-blooded can it be? "Please examine it to see whether it's your son's tunic or not." Good grief. Verse 33, then he examined it and said, "It is my son's tunic. A wild beast has devoured him. Joseph had surely been torn to pieces." So Jacob tore his clothes and put sackcloth on his loins and mourned for his son many days. Then all his sons and all his daughters arose to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. And he said, "Surely I'll go down to Sheol in mourning for my son." So his father wept for him. Well, they weren't really serious about comforting him. What was the thing they could have said to comfort him? He's still alive. We threw him into a pit and we sold him into Egypt. I mean, if they continued insisting on being stupid, they could have asked him was to go after him. That would have been the words of comfort. But instead they maintained the lie. Lies are not comforting. There's no way you could comfort somebody out of a lie. Verse 36, meanwhile, the Midianites sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, Pharaoh's officer, the captain of the bodyguard. That meanwhile kind of sets up the stage. I'm assuming everybody knows the story of Joseph, so we don't have to go forward and find out that, yes, indeed, there's a happy ending. That God does work this out in the life of the family. And by the time he works it out, he also apparently works the bloodthirstiness out of these brothers, so that they're quite different people at the time. But you can kind of see all the things that are going on here. That why in the world, I mean, Reuben wanted to save the kid. Why in the world didn't he? He was going along with the crowd. All he would have done is really stand tall, and he could have brought this outcome differently. Yeah, I know God intended all this to take place so that everybody's life could be preserved. But that doesn't leave people individually as guiltless. God sort of works that. It's sort of like what we were reading in the Torah portion from Numbers 11, that God gives people what they want but brings consequences. So too, God uses people's evil actions, but that doesn't remove responsibility for those evil actions from the people who commit them. And you see this in the life of this family too. So Reuben and the rest of them, this mob psychology to do this bloodthirsty, awful thing, it's not unique to Jacob and his sons. And you look at our own lives, and we look at times when we've gone along with the crowd, and the day after, or you might say the morning after, you say, why in the world did I do that? Why didn't I just stand up and do something? It could be something as simple as telling someone about the Lord, and you're all there, and everything's looking good, and you're with the crowd, and you're just like there's no gas in the car. You turn the key, and the engine runs, but it doesn't get started. You don't really get the words out. Well, what in the world's going on? This kind of mob psychology that you get along in. You look at some famous examples of mob psychology and you wonder what in the world happened there. And most famously, you look at Germany in the 1930s when a whole nation went mad. What in the world happened to turn, shopkeepers and bakers and butchers and all the rest of it into these bloodthirsty individuals with regard to the Jews and the gypsies and the rest? It's like, what happened? Why were there no voices to stand up and take more than a halfway stand on what's going on? In our own lives, when we are faced with things going on around us at work, in our family, in our neighborhoods, in our country, if we can influence it, then why in the world do we just take these halfway measures? We just kind of go a little ways. And our argument in our mind is, oh, at least I'm better than those guys. At least I tried to do something. Kind of like Reuben. But there's so much more that you could have done. You're there at work and somebody is, they're talking about somebody savaging their reputation. You say, well, I didn't say anything. I didn't go along with them. But did you speak up for this person? There's a temptation that you're facing. Something that you know is wrong. Something that you succumbed to before. And you're watching the process unfold like a movie in front of you. Because you know what's going to happen, because you've seen it happen so many times before. And all that you need to do is get up and leave the theater. But you don't. You succumb to that flow, that psychology, that mob psychology, that way everything has always been done before. Get up. Do something different this time. And you complain that, well, I never get an opportunity to this or that, or this never works. Well, then stop doing it. Do something different this time. Try standing up and going the extra mile. People say, oh, I've never gotten the chance to speak to anyone about the Lord. Well, have you ever tried? Well, the opportunity's never come up. Well, I bet it did. I bet it did. It's just you were looking the other way when it came by. You didn't see it. It's like that, you know, rabbit crossing the yard. Everybody says, look, there's a rabbit. But you were looking at your newspaper. You didn't see it. There might be an opportunity. You say, well, I've never had an opportunity to minister to someone in need. But there's this guy who empties the trash can at work that's wondering how he's going to feed his family the next day. And you don't know because you never talked to him. Never even said hi. He's just invisible. Right? Because nobody else at work speaks to him. If I talked to him, I'd be people looking at me as weird, you know? Nobody talks to them. Well, maybe you should. Maybe you should. Everybody at work cuts corners and pads expense accounts and, you know, overstates what progress has been made. And that's just how it's done. Yeah, you're right. That's how it's done. But that's not how you do it. You stop doing that. You stand up. You stop taking these halfway measures. And you do something different. Mob psychology, you can watch the progression of this family. We've talked about Jacob's responsibility before, so I don't want to belabor it too much. But Jacob's kids are out of control. And when they started going out of control, nothing was done to restrain them. They got further out of control. You look at their lives and you say, well, what were their negative consequences for the events in Shechem? The answer is, well, nothing. Well, that means something worse is going to happen. They had to be reined in. You have to rein yourself in. You have to be conscious of what's going on around you. You have to be conscious of what the people around you, in the New Covenant, it talks about the God of this world and the world system. It's really not the philosophy that honors God. It's that, you know, you hear people talk about dog eat dog and all the rest of that, the cliches, and you have to stand up for yourself and you have to make a difference and all the rest of it. And you got to stop and say, well, you have to examine that and say, is this a godly thing or not? You know, I talked about dropping the banana as far as work was concerned, that image of having to give up on something that just was not the direction God wanted me to go in. But yet, it's something that still has to be batted down, because that is that desire, you know, almost like we saw in the Torah portion again about the greedy rabble. It's like that dissatisfaction with what you've got that is part and parcel of living in our consumer society, that there are massive forces arrayed all around us to make us profoundly dissatisfied with our lives. Right? You look, turn on the TV and you don't see people driving old clunkers in the road, enjoying their cars and saying, well, you know, it's falling apart, but it gets me to work. You don't see that. You see people driving these magnificent automobiles saying, oh, my life is perfect now, I've got this car. It was terrible before, but now I've got this car and it's wonderful. And all these things that, you look out at the thing in the driveway and you say, oh, maybe if I had a car like that, my life would be wonderful too. You know, dissatisfaction. And all the rest of it just piles on, even at the job. You know, I've gone to presentations by upper management where they speak derisively of those who aren't seeking promotion into management. Of not taking, you know, people who don't have the initiative to move on with their careers. And just other people have, you know, the strength of character was implied to kind of move on and move up. And you're sitting there thinking, well, you know, what does that make me? I don't want to move up. And every now and then it kind of pulls you into the riptide and you say, well, you know, ambition and greed and all the rest of it starts overcoming. No. Don't go along with the mob, because the mob's not going in a place you want to go. It may not take you there right away, but eventually it's going to take you to a place that you don't want to go. Just like Reuben didn't set off that day saying, I'm gonna sell my brother into slavery today. But it just happened. He was part and parcel there. He let it happen. And if you close your eyes and try to not rock the boat and not stand up for anything, then you're going to sit down that boat and that boat's going to take you places. And that place is going to, you're going to be a victim of the current. And where it takes you is an pleasant place. You can hear the roar of the waterfall just around the next bend. Waterfalls are pleasant to look at from the shore and not so pleasant to look at from a boat heading towards them. Don't be part of the mob. This is one of those interesting parts of Scripture where you look at it and say, well, who did the right thing? Okay, next chapter. I guess the closest was Joseph in here, because even though he bragged about his dreams, part of that was just being 17 years old, but the rest of his life seems to be... There was stuff there that God seemed to be able to be used more than what he used in the rest of the brothers, because Joseph seemed to be willing to do what his father had asked him to do, but still, even that, there's stuff there that was just, oof, not there. I'd be remiss if I didn't say that this happy ending, that even though it looks like that no good deed will go unpunished with this whole story, that in the end of it, it's just God working everything together. And we'll get more into that as we get further down into the story. And I also must add something that I neglected to mention at the beginning, that some people go wild about taking Joseph's life as a prophetic picture of Yeshua's life. However, I'm very, very, very cautious about doing that, because nowhere in the New Covenant does it make reference to that. And so when the New Covenant doesn't use him as a symbol, then you have to be very, very careful on using him as an allegory for Yeshua's life. Let's pray. Dearest God and Father, forgive us for times that we've gone along with the mob. There have been ample times in our lives when we did not speak and we should have. We let the mob carry us into doing things that we never would have done if we were by ourselves. Open up our eyes that we might see all around us, that we might clearly discern the good from the evil, that we might understand the direction you want us to go in, and give us an understanding of the power and the courage that you give us in your Spirit to stand up for what's right and to accomplish great things for you, things that we don't wake up the next morning being ashamed of, but rather things that we can be satisfied are for your glory and for the glory of the kingdom of our Messiah, Yeshua. Amen. Thank you.